Daniel Mendelsohn is a critic, writer and translator. You might have read him in The New Yorker or The New York Review of Books. Daniel has one of those wonderfully wide-ranging critical minds. He writes with erudition and passion on everything from Mad Men to Herodotus. And when I spoke with Daniel at the Sydney Writers' Festival last year, he was working on a new book about reading Homer's Odyssey with his dad.
I actually read the Odyssey when I was in high school, I think it must have been. And I remember very specifically the circumstances. My father had a colleague whose wife was a high school English teacher in the school that I attended. And she wasn't my teacher, but she knew I was already sort of interested in mythology. And it's funny because I write about her in my new book. And she said to me at one point, well, you know, if you're interested in mythology, you should really try the Odyssey. Students your age just love it. So I read it, and I was hooked for life, basically.
And why at that age in particular? What is it about that story?
Well, I think that, you know, in general, I mean, that's the received wisdom, that younger people like the Odyssey, and as you get older, the Iliad starts making more sense to you, which is much tougher. It's about war. It's a very grim story in many ways. But the Odyssey is, look, it's sort of proto-science fiction, right? It's adventures in these strange realms with peculiar creatures and monsters and aliens and drugs and magic potions and transformations. And so I think to the young child's imagination or a sort of a young adult's imagination, it's got everything you could want.
Except it's interesting, the Iliad is the book, the epic of young manhood, of sort of machismo, and the Odyssey is the book of old age.
It's about, yes, at least middle age, right? And so, well, also, I think you're right, actually, because, of course, Odysseus's final reunion is not actually with his wife, it's with his father. So there's a sense of coming full circle. And yet, you could say that its concerns might be middle age, but its plot is filled with fun. You know, it's fun. And also, I would say the crucial thing is that there's a lot of humor in the Odyssey. You know, there are jokes and puns and all kinds of things that make it sort of enjoyable. It's got a lot of plot, and I think young people like that. So it certainly got me hooked, at any rate.
And just the name itself, Odysseus, that's a rich word in and of itself.
Yes, I mean, the interesting thing about the name of Odysseus, which is the subject of great debate, is that it's connected to the Greek word odune, or it seems to be, which is the word for pain. And there's some element, you know, we think that his sufferings on his return home are what makes him his character in some way. And so he is the man of pain, right? That's what his name means. And there's actually an extended flashback in the Odyssey to the naming, the moment when as a baby, he got his name from a very difficult grandfather, a sort of trickster character, who basically says, you know, I've caused a lot of people a lot of pain, and so I'm going to give my grandson this name. And yet that's a theme of the Odyssey. He suffers a lot to get what he wants.
He suffers, and he's a trickster, or a bullshitter, as you describe him.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very funny, because in the book that I'm writing is about the experience I had of reading the Odyssey with my late father in the last, what turned out to be the last year of his life. And my father was a scientist and really didn't like Odysseus, actually. It's very funny. And the reason why is that we, you know, people like us who are journalists and writers and, you know, love Odysseus because he's a fabulist. You know, he makes up stories, he lies, he bullshits his way through situations. And my father has a very kind of mathematical mind. Couldn't bear any of that. You know, he said, why is this guy such a hero? He lies all the time. And I thought, that's the difference between a mathematician and a writer. You know, we think he's great. You know, in some way, I always think he's sort of the proto Woody Allen. He's sexy because he's smart. You know, he's not like Achilles. He's not the greatest warrior. He's not the fastest runner. He can't bench press 300 pounds. But he seduces people all the time, both literally and figuratively, because he has a way with words. So how could people like us resist that? You know? Or how could readers resist that?
So when you say that this is not the kind of intellectual world that your own father came out of, why did you both decide to read the book together?
Well, it was my father's idea, actually. He had, as many people then did, when he was a teenager in the 1940s, going to a public school in New York City, studied Latin, and actually, as is true of many math-oriented kids, he was very good at Latin. And he had this idea, and he always encouraged me to study the classics, sort of vicariously. He liked the idea that I was going on where he had not. He just wanted to reread the classics. So I said to him, you know, well, I'm actually teaching a seminar for first-year students. You know, we're talking about 17 and 18-year-old freshmen at university. And he said, I'll come. I'll sit in on it. And that was the beginning of this sort of, you know, our own odyssey. And he came every week. He drove 3.5 hours from the house I grew up in to where I teach. And he sat in, you know, not quietly, I must say, was sort of cantankerously disagreeing with me about everything. But that was the origin of this sort of very interesting adventure we had.
And you then did the thing that all good readers of the Odyssey should do, which is you go to Greece and you try to follow in Odysseus's footsteps.
Well, what happened was, so that was the spring term of 2011, which runs from January to May. And just by coincidence, although I'm beginning to think there are no coincidences, an old mentor of mine said, well, you know, I just heard about this cruise that recreates the voyages of Odysseus, follows in the footsteps of Odysseus from Troy to Ithaca over 2 weeks, whatever it was. So I mentioned this to my father half jokingly, because my father, among other things, is notoriously cheap. He hated to spend money. And I said, well, you know, I heard about, and he said, let's go. I thought, good grief, you know, in his old age, he's relaxing. And he said, I want you to get the nicest cabin. And because I think he was very pleased with himself that he had followed this course and that he really had mastered this text, even though he didn't much like Odysseus. And we went on this cruise, which was extraordinary. You know, you think, oy, 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 it's going to be a little goofy. And I have to say, well, imagine who goes on an Odyssey cruise. And this was, I should say, it was very serious. You know, it was not a thing you go on because you want all-you-can-eat shrimp, you know. there was a reading list. There were 2 lectures a day by classicists, archaeologists, you know. So it was serious. And wonderful people. We made such good friends, you know, people, Odyssey groupies, people who had interesting family stories, a family who just lost a sister, wanted to do something that was meaningful to them, you know. So this idea of the man of pain came back, and interesting, a Dutch, elderly Dutch gentleman who had been saved during World War II by the intervention of a classics professor, said he wanted to go as a sort of a repayment of this great gift he had from this classics professor in 1945. So, you know, who knows? But that itself was so Odyssean, right? That everyone has a story and you don't know what it is until you sit down over a meal and people start talking. Yeah. It was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's kind of appropriate in terms of the misadventures that Odysseus has on his journey that you didn't actually make it to Ithaca.
No. So the joke was, of course you're supposed to end in Ithaca, this island, which people think is the Ithaca of Odysseus. And what happened was, this is in June of 2011, there was a general strike. It was when the Greek sort of crisis was at its nadir. And the people who the workers who operate the Corinth canals were on strike. And that meant for us to get back to Athens in time for our flights back to wherever people were coming from, we had to miss Ithaca because we had to sail around the entire country of Greece, basically, to get back from where we were to Athens. So people, at that point, people knew what I was up to, my dad and I, and at that point I knew I was going to write a book about this. And people kept coming up to me and saying, oh, this is so terrible for you, you know, here after all this, you're never going to get to Ithaca. And I said, no, this is so great, actually. It's so Odyssean that your destination always eludes you, you know. And I thought it was actually kind of great. So the captain of the ship, who knew I was a writer and a translator of the modern Greek poet Kavafi, who has a very famous poem called Ithaca, said to me very kindly, he said, you know, we have to do something during this day we have at sea with nothing except sailing. And he said, since we're not going to get to the real Ithaca, would you mind giving a lecture about Kavafi's poem Ithaca, and that will be our Ithaca. So I just thought it was so ideal, actually. The substitution of literature for life was somehow so Homeric. I thought it was great.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's another, as you say, you've translated Constantine Cavafy, the Alexandrine poet, who took Homeric themes in a range of his works, and as well as that beautiful poem Ithaca, which is about the journey and the journey over the destination, which is a terrible, that sounds like a Hallmark card as opposed to the Cavafy poem. But there's this other wonderful poem of his I love about the Odyssey, which is a much more severe work, the Second Odyssey.
Yeah.
Where Odysseus leaves again.
Yeah, it's an early, one of Cavafy's early poems that he then sort of came back to and reworked as the poem we know as Ithaca. And you're right, you know, to describe Ithaca is always makes it sound so Hallmarky, you know, but it isn't, as we know. But A Second Odyssey is very tough, and it's interesting because in the 19th century you have a number of poems which explore what you might call the dark side of the Odyssey, or rather Odysseus, which is when you are a person for whom the voyage is more important than the destination, the question then arises, are you ever going to be happy when you finally do get home? And that, you know, is something that I thought about a lot when I was working as I'm concluding my book, actually, about this experience, because in that poem, as you rightly point out, Odysseus already has his eye on leaving and hitting the road again and going home. Tennyson famously has a poem, Ulysses, which is about the same thing, that once he gets home, he realized that what he really liked was not being home, which was traveling. So that kind of tension between the pleasures of voyaging and exploring and seeing new worlds and the satisfactions of coming home are always in a kind of suspicious competition with each other, you know. And there's definitely a sense already in the Odyssey that the kind of person you have to be Odysseus makes you the kind of person that maybe isn't a person who wants to sit around playing checkers with Penelope and drinking, you know, herbal tea once you get home. You know.
So there's that devastating line, it bored him and he left.
Yeah. So I think that's in that sense, the not arriving, the sense that your destination is always over the horizon and you have to go a little bit further. It's already present in the Odyssey. You know, there are many instances in the Odyssey where the men sort of want to get back on the ship because they sense that there's some danger. And Odysseus says, no, I'm just very curious to see what this island is like. And then something terrible happens.
5 years pass.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that it's also about curiosity. I think it's also a parable about intellectual curiosity, which is never ending. But if, you know, if you always want to see over the next ridge, so to speak, intellectually, where does it end? Can you always be in motion? There's a wonderful episode in the Odyssey that sort of dramatizes what you might call the dangers of that, where Odysseus ends up on a floating island, the island of Aeolus, the king of the winds, which the island itself is always in motion. And there's something very creepy about that. You know, you want to, most of us anyway, want to arrive at a fixed destination that's not mobile. And so you always feel with that one episode that there's something creepy. He has six sons and six daughters and they're all married to each other. There's this sort of endless circularity that's not quite wholesome, you know.
Daniel, I wonder if the experience of reading the Odyssey with your father, did it lead you to reflect on the book in a different way? Did your father's criticisms of Odysseus, say, make you see this book that you know so well in a new light?
Well, I think that it forced me, as all good students do, you know, to re-examine my own assumptions. You know, my father basically had two main problems. And that was, A, how heroic is Odysseus, really? You know, we keep talking about him as a hero, and yet he said, oh, all kidding aside, you know, his lies get people in trouble. You know, there's something to be said for the fact that he's the only one of the Ithacan contingent that returns home from the Trojan War alive. How good a leader is he?
He's a survivor, perhaps, rather than a hero.
Right, exactly. And I think my father was right to attach to this slightly uneasy quality, you know, about the Odyssey. If you're going to be the hero of the poem, you have to be alone, right? You have to be the only one standing at the end of the war. And he also had a lot of problem with the gods, as many students do. You know, how much of what Odysseus does is his own cleverness? How much is he being helped by Athena? You know, my father, who was a self-made man, and this is a sort of running joke of my book, he couldn't bear the idea that Odysseus got any help. You know, and there are many instances in the Odyssey where he washes up on an island and Athena sort of waves a magic wand and he looks fabulous and his hair is perfect and everything. My father hated that stuff. But all kidding aside, it was very touching for me because I had a real sense of that aspect of my dad, you know, that he had done it all himself. And he didn't like the idea that some smooth-talking seducer had a whole epic devoted to him when he gets all this help from the gods. You know, so a lot of the book is about, you know, my experience. I was close to my father, you know, but I understood a lot about him from reading this poem together. And that's sort of the best thing that can happen when you're reading, you know, is to have insight not only into yourself, but into other people as well. The poem became a kind of a lantern that illuminated aspects of my dad's personality that I hadn't really appreciated before, you know, and his absolute opposition to the idea that you would get help in your project was very touching for me, you know.
The writer, critic, and translator Daniel Mendelsohn, who was in Australia last year for the Sydney Writers' Festival. And you get a sense of the range of Daniel's critical interests by the fact that when he was at the Writers' Festival, he was on a panel about TV with Ben Law and a panel about the classics with David Malouf and another panel on translation. So he's got a pretty unique critical mind. I really recommend his essays if you haven't come across them yet. And that memoir on reading the Odyssey with his dad will be published soon. You're with Books and Arts on RN. I'm Sarah Kanoski.